lawsuit charging the Trump administration with targeting immigrant rights activists with surveillance and deportation.
Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted child activist Dr. Bob Sanborn and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Mandy?
Hello, hello.
Hey, hey, hey. How's it going? Don, thank you so much, man.
Yeah, happy Monday.
Well, yeah, happy Monday, and thank you guys.
Yeah, so good show today, Mandy.
Yes, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well.
Yeah?
I had a weekend away, right?
Mm-hmm.
The little wife and I, we went over to Port Aransas, Mustang Island. We went down there for a long weekend. It was fantastic. Have you ever been down there to the beach?
A nice getaway.
I mean, it wasn't swimming
weather. I've been to Port Aransas. I don't know if I've been to Mustang
Island. That's the beach part, right? And so it's not swimming weather, but it was good beach walking. We brought our little pooch with us, and it was really fun. So,
yeah. Well, good for you.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have a nice weekend, Mandy?
And now we're back at it. I did. It was productive, you know.
Productive.
Do you like that?
Yeah,
productive.
Yeah.
So I have a 6 and a 9-year-old, so it's always busy bringing them to and fro and that kind of fun, you know. It's not relaxing. Let's pretend like,
this is a show about kids.
That's right.
It's wonderful to have kids.
It is.
It's always fun.
Very much so.
Except when it isn't.
But it always fills your heart, and that's what's important.
But there are times, aren't there?
Yeah.
That try our patience, but we're all about how wonderful kids
every
are.
Every day.
Yeah.
It's a fun journey.
Every day. So, hey, on the show today, our Data Head segment. That's your favorite segment, too, isn't it, Mandy, the Data Head?
I really like it.
Yeah. So today, Patrick Gill is our Data Head. He's with the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation of Children at Risk. And the number today, Mandy, 5.8 billion. Billion.
Mm-hmm.
5.8 billion.
Big number.
So, should be interesting, right?
It'll be really good. Yeah. Can't wait to talk about it today.
And is he
gonna, I know what it is.
And is he going to spotlight Black History Month as well?
That's what we're doing this month.
Wow.
Yes, sirree.
Yeah, Patrick will be good at that.
And then after Datahead, we'll be talking to Mary Lawler.
Lawler.
From Avenue CDC, and Mary's going to be giving a Hurricane Harvey recovery update this week with a focus on housing.
They do wonderful work over there at Avenue CDC, right?
That's right. And there's a lot of stuff going on at the federal level in regards to recovery, so hopefully she'll touch on that.
Mary's top notch. We're going to have Alicia Bell on. She is with EAST, the Environmental and Spatial Technology Group, and they're out of Arkansas, Mandy, and she's over at Armorall High School in Arkansas. And the EAST program gives students access to technology, and then it challenges them to use it to solve real-world problems. So we're going to have Alicia talking a little bit about that and what's unique about that program. And I'm excited about that.
That is exciting.
Yeah, it'll
be a great conversation. And today on our social conscience scale, we want you to call in and share your opinion, thumbs up or thumbs down. And today we'll be talking about, should teacher certifications be required?
So do you need to be certified to teach?
Right. I mean, and at first glance, right?
You would think
of course. That's a no-brainer, but it's actually quite complicated. I'm not saying
there's
thumbs
a whole
up or thumbs
thing
down,
here.
But
it's so complicated. We're going to have from our Center for Parenting and Family Wellbeing and a former Teach for America alumni, Edith Rahimian, who's going to be in. She's going to weigh in with her thoughts on teacher certification as well. But off the top, I think when we talked about this at the staff meeting this morning, Mandy, you were like, no, you need to be certified, right? I mean, that was our first thought. You and I both.
No, I didn't really say that.
No.
I mean, let's talk about it. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
What I am for is quality teachers.
Absolutely.
And so I don't know if it's as simple as, oh, now you're certified and
you're
quality.
So 57% of the teachers in the Houston Independent School District have alternative certification.
Right.
So they didn't even go to the School of Education, right?
Right.
They're alternatively certified. But who's to say that's not the best either, right?
Right, so. No. But what it does say is that nearly half of the teachers, we're not producing enough teachers.
Yeah,
right? If we're having to find others who are being certified, or at least not enough quality teachers.
That's right. We'll open up the phone lines, let people call in. Last week the phone lines went wild, or the week before, the phone lines went wild with people calling in. So But that's when
we can still do it.
Yeah. Teacher certification. It's a hot topic. It's a very hot topic. People will be calling in on that. Our final guest today will be Oscar Underwood. Dr. Oscar Underwood is a founder of a big college prep school out in Indiana. But he was, more importantly, he was the first African-American Teacher of the Year in Indiana back in the day, a couple of years back. And but he's been doing all sorts of interesting things, and he's really interested in this whole idea of educational equity, which you and I are all over this, right? But he's doing this in Indiana, so should be an interesting thing.
I'm looking forward to hearing from him. Yeah,
Indiana. I didn't know it was a big deal up there, right? I mean, I think of Indiana sort of being like Larry Bird country, right? It's like not very, but you have
times change.
Gary, Indiana's up there. Mm-hmm. You know, the suburbs of Chicago, right in Indiana. It's a very different area up there, so it's be interesting to talk around that.
We are going to have a fabulous show today. Like, fabulous.
That's what I'm saying. Fabulous show. Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio. This is a discussion on our children, public policy, politics, and our future. How do we do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids? Mandy, how do we do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids?
We can do better.
We can do so much better.
There's some positive things going on out there, and we have to acknowledge it.
I think
but we can
better,
do better.
But, you know, it's always a struggle, right? We're always working hard. But you ready for a little data head?
Let's do it.
Ready. Little poetry in motion with our good buddy Patrick Gill, who's our data head today. He's with the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation at Children at Risk. My buddy Patrick, how you doing, man?
I'm great. How are you, Dr. Bob?
Very, very
happy
good.
Happy Monday.
I'm Andy.
So the number.
Did you hear that? Hi, Mandy.
Hi, Mandy. Hi, Dr. Bob.
I'm like giving
Mandy.
All this love.
But we know he likes you better, right? He likes you a lot.
Well, I don't blame him, but I mean, thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, we know that. We know that. So the number today, Patrick?
My number is 5.8 billion.
Is that the number of stars visible from Marfa, Texas?
No, although
not this time of year.
That number, what it is, it's $5.8 billion. It's the amount that was added to the Child Care and Development Block Grant last week as part of the bipartisan budget deal.
So that's good news, though, Patrick, isn't it?
Yes, that's great news. So what the CCDBG does is it is a block grant distributed across the states that funds subsidized child care in the different states. And so we, as being one of the biggest states in the country, we get about a tenth of that money. And basically, it's split over 2 years, so it's $2.9 billion per year split across the 50 states. And if you add our portion to our current allocation from the CCDBG, it's about a 50% increase over our current budget, so it's huge.
So tell us, so right now, how much does the state receive, the state of Texas, get in this child care subsidy money?
Well, so the money, the CCDBG money is given to Texas Workforce Commission. That's the office in Texas that administers
so what is
funds.
It? It's
and
about
the
five...
TWC gets our child care budget every year is about $534 million.
And so $534 million and... Which will increase to what now?
It'll add 50% to that, so somewhere in the ballpark of $750 million.
Wow,
that's what they're projecting.
That's a big deal, Mandy.
To put it in here, what these dollars do, and I heard you say child care subsidy, Patrick, but for those who are not aware, that the Texas Workforce Commission allocates through federal dollars to help low-income working families who have to work, but child care is extremely expensive. And we look across the state, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of families on waiting list, and it puts them in a hard spot because they have a job barely making enough money to feed their kids, let alone pay hundreds of dollars a week for their kids. So what we're really excited about is not only will it give more families access to child care, but it'll also help improve the quality of early education.
That was my question, Patrick. Quality. How do we think, I know it's early, but how do we think this will impact quality of early education?
Well, if the funding mechanism is the same and they're just increasing the amount as it currently is, every the 28 local workforce boards are in charge of administering the funding through their, for their area, and each of them has to spend 2% of their funding allocation on quality initiatives. So you're taking that money, and you're also increasing that by 50%. So every workforce board should have a lot more money on hand to devote to quality initiatives, and maybe that would give them an opportunity to experiment and try out some of the exciting things we're seeing in places like Tarrant County that are really trying to increase parental demand for quality child care.
In the end, Mandy, though, $750 million, it should all go to quality, don't you think, in a sense?
Well, it's, again, a difficult conversation. Mm-hmm. So Mandy Children at Risk says that quality early education is a priority because we know that it produces great outcomes.
Right.
But that being said, across the state with some people, it's this tug of war of, well, do you improve quality or do you help more families who are on that waiting list access child care? So maybe it's not as great as they would hope. But the thing is that when you look at kindergarten readiness, we are falling behind.
We are.
Right? And so it can't just be those basic.
It can't be just babysitting.
It can't just
be much more than
that's
that.
That's right. It needs to be quality
and
early learning.
And Patrick, we've done too much research on this at Children at Risk to understand that when you have this quality, if we focus on quality with some of this money or all of this money, the outcomes are significantly better for our children.
Yeah, across the board. Mandy already mentioned school readiness, but there's also like outcomes much later in life. High school, college graduation rates, incarceration rates are lower for children that had quality early education. They're more likely to be employed. Their lifetime earnings are higher. Kind of across the board, all these great indicators are tied to quality early education.
Great.
All right.
Thank you, Patrick. Now, we're also going to ask you another question and because it is Black History Month. And so thus in February, we're talking about books that are recommended for children or families, parents. What do you have for us today?
They want to celebrate Black History Month. White families, Black families, Latino families. What should they be reading?
So I read a book right at the beginning of this year that I thought would be really good for this topic. It's called Dear Martin, and it's by Nick Stone. And Dear Martin is a young adult novel. So it's a fairly easy read, but it's also it's pretty advanced, like thematically. I wouldn't recommend it for anybody younger than, you know, eighth grade or high school.
Still good for those grades, right?
Yeah, great for those grades. And so what Dear Martin is the main character is he's a high school student named Justice McAllister, and he's a scholarship student at a really prestigious boarding school in Atlanta. He's a Black teenager, and it kind of follows his journey navigating largely white spaces at this prestigious boarding school, and then as well as his relationship with his best friend, Manny, who is also Black but is from a really affluent family. His dad is like an NFL Hall of Famer in the story.
Wow, so that's an
eye-opener.
I love this idea of, so that's good. Patrick Gill is with the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation at Children at Risk, and Dear Martin by Nick Stone. And good news on that $5.8 billion, Patrick. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so, great news. We'll see we'll see what it looks like on the ground in the next couple years.
Patrick, keep up the great work, and thank you so much for being on our program today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mandy. Bye, Bob.
Bye, Mandy.
Bye, Bob.
So, hey.
I made him feel bad.
Yeah, does. So he was like enthusiastic. Bye, Mandy. Yeah. Happy to do that. So, hey, up next, are we ready for a little?
No place to hang out or washing.
So, this is a little Electric Avenue, Mandy.
Oh, no, we're going to rock down to Electric Avenue.
Is it loud or is it just me? I love it, right? I love this music. Don, did you put that loud on purpose? Is that it?
You already know it.
It's a good tune.
So not Electric, but we're going to go to the Avenue CDC. Mary, how do you like that theme music for you, Electric Avenue? You like that?
Wow, thank you. That was a great introduction.
Mary Lawler is...
Welcome to Growing Up in America.
Mary Lawler is the executive director. She's the big cheese over at Avenue CDC, one of the great community development corporations in the city of Houston, one of the great ones in the country. Mary, how you doing personally? You doing pretty well?
I'm doing well, thank you. It has been a wild ride for the past, 5 months since Hurricane Harvey, but we are hanging on.
So, Mary, are you like us where you feel like you're doing 2 or 3 jobs now, all the Hurricane Harvey stuff plus your regular work?
Very much so, yes. So Avenue, we've introduced 2 new programs to help people who were affected by the storm and added a number of new staff members to help out there, and it's been a lot. But we are, I think, now feeling like we're getting to a place where we know what we're doing, and we're doing it, and I think we're helping a lot of people.
So, Mary, when people ask you, how is Hurricane Harvey going, recovery going, what do you say?
Slowly. I think it's going too slowly for the folks who were flooded in the storm. The strange thing is that for many Houstonians at this point, life has gotten back to normal. There's not a lot of signs of the storm any longer. So for most Houstonians, they've really moved on. But for people who were flooded and whole neighborhoods that were affected, and especially in low-income neighborhoods, they really have not recovered and are really still in a crisis.
You know, Mary, I just, for the weekend, I went down to Mustang Island, Port Aransas, and driving through Rockport and Aransas Pass and Port Aransas, you see devastation, right? There's still, you see it out there, right? It's, these towns were devastated, lots of debris all over the place. You see buildings that are all over the place. But when I would mention that I was from Houston and we talked about, everyone was like, oh, like, even in those places that are devastated, they feel like Houston had the worst of it. There's no competition. Lives are devastated across the board. But in some ways, when you're flooded, right, you don't see as much devastation outwardly, but it's just as bad in terms of the rebuilding.
That's true. You know, and there's a lot of people who are not able to live in their homes right now. So they're in hotels or doubled up with friends and family members. And then there's a whole bunch of other people who are in their homes, but their homes have not been restored. And so they're living in conditions that are very poor with, without sheetrock, without heat. I mean, there's really a lot of dire situations out there.
Mary, I saw you at a legislative hearing a month ago or so at City Hall talking about Hurricane Harvey and housing. And I remember that Mayor Turner was saying how there were still 4,000 people who were still living in hotels. And that doesn't even count the people who are partnering up with friends and family that you mentioned. And the message, the big message or takeaway from that was, we need the feds to allocate those dollars and get them to Texas. And I know that there have been conversations, and last week there's budgets being passed. What is your take on the federal dollars and what it can do for Houston in regards to housing?
Well, the federal dollars are going to be hugely important to helping the city to recover. The unfortunate thing about the federal dollars is that they take a very long time to flow. So, yes, they have now been approved, but there will still be a series of steps that will have to occur before those dollars will make it to the families in need. So in the meantime, the good news is that there has been a lot of philanthropic funds raised, and those charitable funds are flowing, and, many nonprofit organizations have been responding and repairing homes and providing direct assistance to families in need. And that, that has helped to fill some of the gaps, but the real rebuilding of the neighborhoods that were devastated, that's going to take those larger federal dollars, and that is, I would say, hopefully not a full year, but many months into the future.
Mary, when you look at some of these neighborhoods that have been devastated, and you know, some neighborhoods in Meyerland and so are, and Kingwood are like ghost towns, right? There's just nothing there except for empty homes that have been flooded. How long? You know, a lot of people think we have this can-do spirit in Texas. You know, maybe a year at the most before we recover. But what's the reality? You know, before we recover, you know, we will recover, but how long will it take for some of these neighborhoods to be back?
Well, if we look at the experiences of other cities that have had major disasters, so New Orleans or some of the communities in the Northeast that were affected by Sandy, it can take up to 5 years for a full rebuild from an event like this.
Yeah,
that's a long time.
Well, I know that County Judge Emmett and the mayor, Mayor Turner, are talking about these floodplains, right, and the 100-year floodplains, and we need to expand. What is your take on that, and are you involved in the conversation of kind of remapping and needing more reservoirs?
Well, we have definitely been watching those conversations. You know, there's this real balancing act between helping people to get back into their homes and communities in an affordable way and building for resiliency for the next storm that may hit us. And so, you know, you don't want people to be in temporary quarters indefinitely. You want them to be able to return home or find a new home that they can afford. But on the other hand, rebuilding in places that have flooded, you know, three times in the last 5 years is really throwing good money after bad. And so it is a really tough balancing act. And that's where those federal resources can really come in and help with buyouts in places that perhaps should not be rebuilt in, and then help with a resilient approach to rebuilding, raising houses up in places that, you know, maybe can be rebuilt but maybe need to be built in a different way to protect for the future.
A lot of work to be done out there. It's just amazing. Mary Lawler is the executive director over at Avenue CDC. And can you get information on your website more about some of the stuff that's going on in terms of Harvey recovery, Mary?
Yes. We are offering housing recovery workshops a couple times a week for people who were affected and who need information and on resources to restore their homes.
Very good. Mary, thank you so much for the work that you do, and thank you so much for being on the program today.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
bye. Take care.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America, KPFT, Pacifica Radio. It's Mandy and Dr. Bob, and a lot of work, Mandy, still going on this hurricane recovery. It's amazing stuff.
People, I mean, it's easy to forget, right? But we can't allow
that. Well, some neighborhoods, you just don't see it, right?
Right.
I mean,
no.
I think about Montrose.
People live in their own little bubbles.
We hang in Montrose a lot, and it's just fine. Downtown is fine, but then you go to other areas, and it's devastated, right?
Yep.
So a lot of work to do. Hey, we got some theme music for Alicia Bell. We have some something good. Weird Science, Mandy. Do you remember that song? Were you like a little kid when that came out, Mandy?
Well, I'm quite a few years younger than you, and so yes, I was a little kid.
You're like a little kid. I was a little kid too, Mandy. We're not that far. Alicia Bell's with us. She is the facilitator of EAST at Armorall High School. EAST, what does EAST stand for, Mandy? You remember what EAST stands for?
I do.
What is it?
It is Environmental and Spatial Technology.
Spatial.
Spatial. Or spatial.
No, it's spatial. Alicia, you're not going to let Mandy in your class at all, aren't you? Alicia Bell is with us. Alicia, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm doing very well.
Very
Thank
good.
Thank you.
So where is Armorall High School exactly? And did I pronounce that right?
Yes, you did. We are in the very northeast corner of Arkansas, so right underneath the Missouri Boot Hill.
Oh, yes. Very good. And so EAST has received, the program has received quite a bit of attention. Tell us a little bit about the program, Alicia, and what makes it so special?
Yeah, so it's the EAST Initiative started in Arkansas a little over 20 years ago, and it's a program that's in about It's in 246 schools right now in four states, but since it started in Arkansas, the majority, are in our state. It has approximately 21,000 students enrolled across all the programs. And it's just this great initiative that was started. It's basically a way to, it's a project-based classroom. It provides students with technology, but it challenges them to use that technology to solve problems and serve their communities in some way.
This is exciting.
Right?
And 21,000 students sounds a lot, and I wish all students had access to this, which I think is the future, right? To be able to engage more students. So can you give us a story or an example? What is one of the projects that you're most excited that students have been able to get involved in?
Oh, well, we have so many projects. I couldn't pick this one. I think the one that has gotten the most recognition right now is some of my eighth grade students created a duck prosthetic for a local duck that had his foot bitten off by a turtle. We did not expect this story to go viral, but it did, and it went international. So that's kind of been the new, but it's a great project because it kind of encompasses everything that we do.
Right.
I teach 7th through 12th grade, so our school is a very small school. We have less than 450 students K through 12. We're all on the same campus. So in my classes that meet all across the day, I have 7th through 12th grades all in the same class, and it works out. I mean, just great, because they each bring something different to the table. And sometimes, you know, even my older students do bring experience and their knowledge, but also just like this group, my eighth graders, know more than most of my older students in the 3D modeling and that type of sophisticated software. Age is not a determination of what they can do.
I mean, it's exciting because it's not only technology, but it's team building, right? And then also social justice almost, or getting involved trying to improve what's going on in your community and how can you help others. It just brings so many critical values to a child's life.
Alicia, when you look at kids that are involved in the EAST program, whether it's at your school or other schools in Arkansas, do you see that outcomes in terms of how they're doing overall academically, they're getting better because of this sort of hands-on type of experience with EAST?
Oh, absolutely. We have presented all over the state this year, and we have some virtual reality projects that we're doing, and that's kind of a new initiative of using that in the classroom for educational purposes. But just when we were presenting, we have industrial, you know, businesses that are coming, leaders that are coming and listening to our students and talking to them. And they come up to me and they said, I would hire your student right now. And they're in the 10th grade. And so,
I believe
it's setting them up for success, whether, you know, they're going to college or whether they're doing something different post-secondary. So definitely. And then I talked to EAST and they have studies that have proven that EAST students perform better on standardized tests.
Oh, yeah.
And the longer they stay in EAST, the wider that gap is. So even when you're measuring on that type of, you know, test, they're showing to be more successful.
Can I ask how you're funded? I mean, this is more, if there were other schools who are interested in doing this, you have to pull from your school dollars, or is it foundations?
In Arkansas, they have a grant that you can apply for, and it pays for, you know, almost all of what it takes to put this into your school, because there's initial startup that they bring in. You have computers, software, hardware, and they come and install, and they also provide support to the teachers and to the students. So there's a grant in Arkansas that you can apply for. You can go to their site, eastinitiative.org, to kind of find that out. On other schools, it just depends on their state of how to, I know that, you know, I don't know if there's a grant process for that. So they would just have to kind of do some research.
Yeah. I love this idea. One of the stories that I heard was about the kids sort of using architecture software. Do you know that story as well, Alicia?
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that in regards to the school library.
Yes. So we had a group of students, kind of like the duck prosthetic. So last year I had some seventh grade students, and one thing I was going to say is I get to keep my students, if they choose to be in East, we're very lucky. They can start in seventh grade, and they can stay with me until 12th grade.
That's amazing.
So they can kind of build.
That's good relationship building.
A group of students. Yes. I mean, it makes a world of difference in the classroom. So they started out last year. They were really interested in, so, you know, in East, they get to have, you know, they have agency in their learning. So they come in and they get to pick the technology that they want to learn or the projects that they want to be on. And so I had a group that really were, they were interested in design and building. And so they started learning, architecture software. And so we had some different projects that they worked on with the school last year. They were able to design a new fitness area that was outside and track area. And so this, at the end of last year, our principal wanted to redesign our library, and it just wasn't being utilized to its fullest. And it hadn't been updated in, I don't know if it had ever been updated. And so we wanted to add a makerspace, a cafe, you know, new reading areas. And so they went to our principal and said, you know what, we can do this. Give us this task. And so they showed that initiative, but they were so eager in it. And they worked, and they were given a budget. So it wasn't even just the design part. They were given a budget and had to research and buy the materials. They had to itemize it. They realized real quickly money doesn't go that far when you're buying furniture and things like that. They just thought that they could buy whatever they wanted to, given the amount that they had, because it was astronomical to them. But then they realized, you know, realistically, that's not gonna work. And so that summer, so after they put the design in place, they had the materials, they came up, they painted, they put together furniture. So they just really have been involved in the whole process.
What a great experience for those kids, right, to be able to do all that sort of stuff.
Alicia, and the love for the library, right? They got to create a place for them.
Alicia Bell is the East facilitator over at Armroll High School in Arkansas. And EAST stands for Environmental and Spatial Technology.
Spatial
technology.
Sorry about that.
So, hey, thank you so much, Alicia. Thank you for the work that you do, and thanks for being on Growing Up in America today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty, take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America, KPFT Pacifica Radio. It's Mandy and Dr. Bob. Mandy, you would love to get involved with some spatial technology, right?
I would love to be a part of EAST. That would be fun.
Right? I know.
So would you.
I would, too. I would love it as well. Ready for a little thumbs up, thumbs down?
Know it.
One, two, three, boom! Boom. There's the boom right there. Sorry.
That's
all right. So, thumbs up, thumbs down. Should teacher certifications be required, Mandy?
Should they?
Should you require? So there are lots of options, right? You could do teach without a certification, have an alternative certification, go to education school, become certain, you know, just be automatically certified. I don't know if you're automatically certified, right?
Yeah, or just have a career and then the school waives certifications and you just bring your experience.
Just come right in. So that's what we're talking about today. 713-526-5738 if you want to give your opinion. 713-526-5738. On the line with us is Edith Rahimian. Edith, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Very good. And so Edith is the director of a Center for Parenting and Family Wellbeing, but also a former Teach for America, former dean of instruction at one of our local public schools. And Edith, what's your response to this? Should we require teacher certification?
I think so. My response, which you're going to love, Dr. Bob, is a yes and a no.
Yeah. You can't sit on the fence. You need to give us a thumbs up or a thumbs up. But tell us, what do you think? Tell us. Go ahead.
But can I explain?
Yeah.
So I think that because the majority of alternative teacher certification programs are actually not of quality, I don't see the need for them necessarily, because you can attract people who are experts in their profession to come and actually be career teachers that can teach students based off of their own experience being in that particular career. But I do think that schools then should be required to create some sort of a course that those people would have to take to just still understand things like classroom management, how to teach, how to backwards plan, how to write your curriculum, because those are all really extremely important things that a teacher needs to have in order to be successful. It's not just content knowledge.
713-526-5738, if you want to give us your opinion, 713-526-5738. It seems to me, though, right, Edith, Mandy, that there's a part of me that's saying, listen, to become a lawyer, you need to go to law school. To become a doctor, you need to go to medical school. If you want to be a good teacher, you need to have done more than just do an alternative certification, more than just letting you teach, right? There's a part of me that's thinking, you know, have a major in college, get some really good education classes, and then go out and teach. Aren't those the best teachers, Edith?
Not necessarily, no. I've known plenty of teachers who went through the traditional route and plenty of teachers that went through alternative certification. And sometimes the alternative certification folks were better than the traditional folks.
Yeah. I mean, it all depends on your passion. So for teacher certification, though, the question is, do they teach you how to manage a classroom? Do they teach you the child and brain development? What goes on in teacher certification?
In a yes. good teacher certification yeah. course, what happens?
Yes. The problem is there aren't enough good
ones.
Teacher certification
good ones.
Programs.
Yeah. It's kind of like, thank you for the money. Here's a book. This is a test you need to take. And
is it that simple? Is it as simple as what Mandy's saying, Edith?
It depends on the program. I think there are some online programs that are like that. There are also some programs that do offer the courses. So you're expected to go after you've been teaching all day to a three-hour course once a week or on a Saturday. But it's not current. It's not up to date. And it doesn't teach what you need to be taught dealing with the setting that you may be teaching. And so the urban environment or the rural environment. It's just very much based off of theory, not practice.
It's so much better having Edith here because she knows so much more than you are.
Well, she does, but I'm glad that we're having this conversation because we're highlighting a problem here. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking about alternative teacher certifications. Why? Because we don't have enough teachers. We don't have enough quality right. teachers across the state and the classrooms. And so schools are having to make hard decisions, right?
Yeah.
And just because you went to school and got your bachelor's in education, like Edith said, doesn't mean that you have a passion for kids and want to do it. So if you don't, see you later. You know what I mean? But what are school districts supposed to do? They have to fill those teacher slots so then they can either do alternative certifications. And why this is timely is a couple of sessions ago, there was Districts of Innovation, right?
And so those schools don't even need to do alternative certifications.
So Districts of Innovation, school districts can apply and say, hey, these are the rules that we want to waive out of. And so the top two issues are the school calendar because yep. they want more time. And then the other one is teacher certifications. Because they don't like the alternative certifications.
And frankly, a lot of those alternative certifications are really bad,
yeah.
right?
And yeah, and so they want to bring people who are skilled in technology or STEM to the classroom. And so to be continued how that plays out. I mean, it's just a difficult situation.
So, Mandy, are you thumbs up or thumbs down on should we let teachers – should we require teacher certification?
I mean – I think the question should be, should we require quality teachers? And then I would be thumbs up. And so, however,
well, I don't know who would be thumbs down on that.
However you get there,
I hate those quality
make
teachers.
It happen, right? We're talking about our kids, so however we can get to quality teachers should be allowed.
You're the one who asked for this question, so you, is there a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
I just gave you my answer.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word. And I'm just guessing, Edith, you're just going to say the same thing, right? We just want quality teachers. That's it, right?
That is true. But I would say, so repeat the question again, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Should teacher certifications be required?
It seems to me.
In an ideal world,
it
yes.
seems to me that even if you're not doing if you're a district of innovation and you don't have to do teacher certification, at the very least, you should get classes in classroom management. You should get classes in child development. It seems to me that there are some basic things, even yeah. you know, team building, that even if it's a day-long workshop, there needs to be something. We can't just send people into the classroom thinking they know what they're doing.
And I'm going to assume that school districts would do that.
I would not make those assumptions.
Their liability.
Yeah, I would not make those assumptions.
Yeah, no, I think Edith's right. So what are you saying? Thumbs up, thumbs down on that?
thumbs up. There's got to be some sort of teacher preparation program outside of colleges.
Yeah, I'm with Edith on this one, Mandy.
There we go.
Yeah, so we're...
I'm thumbs up quality teachers.
I'm double thumbs up to quality.
Yeah, we're all thumbs up. I don't know anyone who's thumbs down to quality teachers. I just don't know. And if so, then we're not going to let them on the show, Mandy. So very good.
Thank you, Edith.
Edith, thank you so much for all the work you do. Thank you for being our resident expert today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care. You're listening to Growing Up in America on Pacifica Radio and Mandy and Dr. Bob. Mandy, I feel like I had some outstanding teachers in my life, right? Who really, without those teachers, I would have never thought about going to college. I would have never thought about making something different out of my life. I feel like teachers can have such a dramatic impact on the life of children.
Well, they absolutely, and they do. And I had some really great teachers.
Yeah.
And some not so good
ones. You had some not so good ones? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I may have had a couple of not so good ones.
But it's really
I think of the good ones, though, right?
Yeah, I think of it. But maybe that's because we were lucky and weren't traumatized by a bad one, which could happen as well.
We were lucky. I mean, just look at our place in life. We were lucky, right?
Yeah, so,
that's true. And so I want to talk about another great teacher who we have with us today. And do we have a little bit of theme music, Don, before we get to Oscar Underwood? Theme music. Theme music. I got something to say. I'm gonna put this dream in motion. Never let nothing stand in my way. With us is Oscar Underwood. Oscar is a teacher and an author. He's the author of Bumblebees Can Fly. He was the first African-American to be the Teacher of the Year in Indiana, and he's all about equity in education. Oscar, Dr. Underwood, how you doing, man?
I am doing great, and thank you for having me.
Very good.
Hey, happy Monday. Thanks for joining.
Hey, how's the weather in Indiana right now, Dr. Underwood?
It is in the 20s, and there's snow on just about covering everything.
Wow, I can't believe
nice.
It. I can't believe it. Wow.
We're like in the 40s freezing over here.
Yeah, in the 40s. It's cold for us in Houston. Hey, listen, Dr. Underwood, when you look at equity in education around our country, and even as examples in Indiana, from my vantage, I see a lot of inequity. I mean, are you seeing a lot of the same thing?
I certainly am. I certainly am. And that's why, you know, I figure anything that makes me angry, then I have a moral obligation to do something about it.
And what's happening in Indiana that you're able to attack this? And what's going on that you think is making a difference?
Yeah, well, the school vouchers program is making a significant difference. I started C-PREP's kindergarten through grade 12. 27 years ago, and I did so. I was a principal in public education and went there nine years at an elementary school that had a history of the students not being motivated, parents not being really involved in the school, and the kids not really achieving. And my team, my staff and I, we turned everything around. The parents got mobilized. The students got excited about the experience of learning and growing and dreaming about what they could become. And the school just became an oasis in the middle of a desert. Well, politics and so forth, the things that a lot of times adults do to kids, close the school for racial desegregation purposes, parents crying, the kids crying, and I saw the kids being, their education being sacrificed just for, I mean, of course I believe in integration and diversity and all of that, but I also believe that when poor kids, regardless of what color they are, when they find something that's working for them and they're all of a sudden they have hope, that we need to also try to protect that. So I left public ed and started C-PREP. I took my teacher's retirement money, started the school, and it's been a challenge, but we have great stats. 100% of our 99.7% students graduate in the 27-year history. 100% going to college. About 70% of them are able to be able to achieve retention in college. They're doctors, lawyers, prosecuting attorneys, great mothers, great fathers, engineers all over the country, teaching in Taiwan, China. And they understand that if they have a dream, that one of their greatest affirmations, follow your dream, take one step at a time, that if I hold on to the dream and I work hard and work smart, I can achieve.
Yeah. You know, we're having some of those same conversations about community schools who are not performing as well as expectations are, and should they be closed down or not. And it's really important to those families in that community to try to turn that school around. Wouldn't you say, Dr. Bob?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a heated conversation.
So what do you do about that, Oscar? I mean, talk about inner city. So maybe inner city Gary or inner city Indianapolis. What is your take on when you have these schools that a neighborhood sort of really cares about, and yet they're underperforming? What do we do in those circumstances?
One of the things to do is that expectations is everything. I mean, if you more than just simply telling students and parents that we expect, you know, excellence from you, we've got to demonstrate it. We have and one of the greatest things I learned early on in education, in fact, my first year in education, is that all kinds of miracles can happen in student learning regardless of where the kids are, because God does not place excellence, sprinkle excellence based on zip code. Those schools that are underperforming, it's not because those children do not have the ability to perform. It's because expectations, one, are not high enough, and the enforcement of those expectations are not high enough, and that the support that those principals and those teachers and parents need, who are really vested in those children's education and their growth, the support is not there. I went to the poorest school in the poorest census tract in northern Indiana, and we turned that school around within 2 to 3 years, where they were number 36 in achievement testing. When they closed the school, we had climbed to number 18.
Wow.
They closed the school, in fact, because the kids grew. They were still poor. 99% of them were still on free lunches. Most of them were one-parent homes, gunshots, gangs all around the school. But the parents loved the school because the kids were growing and being protected, and the kids were really beginning to believe that their environment had nothing to do with their potential, and they close the school.
When you look around the country, Oscar, you know, we see a lot of places that want to turn around schools and talk about turning around schools, but it does seem like very few of them. I mean, we know the examples, right? And there are a few, but they're not, we're not seeing enough. And part of it is that it's not a few little silver bullets. It's almost like you're talking about, it has to be a wholesale intervention. I mean, it's like everything needs to change, right? And it starts with a lot of the leadership.
It does, and leadership is a key thing. Unless I'm one that believes that if everybody that's touching kids should be a teacher at heart from the top down, and should be in it not for the paycheck, but in it in order to see for the exhilaration when you see a child that is able to discover the power of learning and the love of learning. And if this and if from the central office throughout every part of the school, the principal's office, everybody is all engaged in those children being able to learn and grow and enjoy the process of learning. It will shock America how well all kids can learn.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You ready for a little Final Four with Dr. Underwood?
Yes. All right, Dr. Underwood, this is an opportunity for listeners to get to know you a bit better. So we have four questions for you. First one is, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
My favorite toy to play with as a kid was, I think it was my kickball. My kickball. I love playing kickball.
Yeah, very good.
And what did you want to be when you were growing up?
I wanted to be an attorney, but I changed my mind going into after graduation and went education. And so now I know I chose right in the end as an educator.
Sounds like it.
You know you did.
And what was your favorite book to read as a child?
Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. I mm-hmm. love the story of the challenges that they went through, but how they still were able to keep intact their dreams and their inner strength.
Very good. And then our final question today: when you think about who's going to play the lead role in the Oscar Underwood story when they make it in Hollywood, Oscar, who do you want to play you?
Oh man, you know what? I would love to see. If Denzel is still around, I would love to see Denzel do it because he's got passion.
He does have passion.
Come on. Everyone wants Denzel to play them. I mean, that's not, I want Denzel to play me. Come on. So Oscar Underwood is up in Indiana. Bumblebees Can Fly is his book. Fantastic teacher, all about education equity. Oscar, Dr. Underwood, thank you so much for being on the program with us today.
And thanks for having me.
All righty. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Mandy.
We should have asked him if he was thumbs up or thumbs down to teacher certification.
Yeah, I wonder what he would have said, right? It would be interesting. I want to talk, though, about we hear a lot of work. We've talked a little bit about education today, but we've heard a lot of talk today about teachers and equity. And when we look in Houston, I was at a luncheon today, mm-hmm. and someone who has worked in charter schools a lot mentioned that charter schools are taking a lot of talent out of our schools. And it was the first time that I've heard people say that, and mm-hmm. I've usually poo-pooed it, but this is someone who I sort of admire a lot saying this. And what do you think, what are the implications when we talk about charter schools really sort of creaming a lot of the kids out of public school? And what impact does that have?
Well, I mean,
it's an interesting question, I can answer
that question, but I also want to focus on what the problem is.
Yeah.
And the problem is that in Texas, our schools are underfunded. Mm-hmm. Right. And they're not supported appropriately. Now, it has to do with the budget. So when we look
and
at
even
the
more so
budget,
when we look at some of our poor schools, schools that have large
right.
numbers of low income, we're not doing enough in terms of funding those schools.
So there's something to be said about our A through F rankings. Right. And you yep. and I have had these conversations forever, and we have been ranking schools for over a decade.
Yeah.
And then now the state is going to start ranking the grades. OK, so we have to do more than just say, okay, you got an A, B, C, D, or F.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about it, right? So this is supposed to be information. It's supposed to help equip parents and school districts on this is the state. Now, what are we going to do? And don't get me wrong, parent involvement, teacher culture, the school leadership, that all means a lot, and you can do a lot with it, probably more than anything. But there are some basic things that just need additional dollars to help get those kids off the ground.
And I would start with full-day pre-K, which we're not funded. I mean,
full-day pre-K. There you go.
And all of our research, I mean, it's probably the thing that has the highest impact. High-quality full-day pre-K can do more than any dropout prevention program, more than any college prep program. It's like one of the things that gets kids ready to learn right as they get into kindergarten.
Right. So there is the underlying problem, which the school formula hasn't been changed in decades and decades and decades.
Yep.
And so the legislature has failed to address this situation. Now, right now, currently, just here recently, mm-hmm. they have put a commission together and they're going to start studying it. So maybe funding could be more equitable, right? So we'll see what comes out of it at the end of this year and if they're going to be ready to tackle it next session or if it's just going to be a continued conversation. Now, to your point on charter schools, right, we're going to keep having that problem, right? For the underfunded. So then now it's like, okay, I am all about try to find the best school for your child, and so are you.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So you can't blame the parents saying, hey, I don't like this. I'm going to go find a better avenue.
Absolutely.
And you can't blame people who say this school is horrible and I'm going to go start another one because then I feel like I have control and I'll get the right people to create the culture and environment that we want. So It's a
now,
difficult.
You can't blame them.
You can't blame them.
But and we see some charter schools that are horrible, but we see some charter schools that are fantastic, right? Some
right.
and some yes, the so, KIPP, IDEA in the Valley. I mean, there's some really good charter schools.
So there's some charter schools who pop up, and do I think that they're taking talent from the schools? Maybe not. Maybe they're getting the unqualified teachers.
But they're not doing a good job either.
But they're not doing a good job.
Right.
So those high quality charter schools who are recruiting the best teachers, and yeah, they're creaming it. But we also know that there's more poor charter schools than there are good charter schools.
Right, especially some of the lower grade, independent sort of seeming charter schools. Interesting stuff. This whole conversation on charter schools, public education as a whole is very interesting. And then I think the other thing, and this came up at a group I was meeting with, is how poorly we do in the state of Texas of getting kids into college, getting them ready for college, getting them into college, and then keeping them in college, right? We have a lower college attendance rate than almost any other state. And if you're in the fifth quintile in terms of income family, if you're growing up in a pretty poor family,
right.
only about 8% chance that you're going to go and graduate from college.
That's really
I mean,
hard.
It's ridiculous, right, that there's so much inequity in terms of kids getting ahead. In this day and age, you have to have a career certificate, a two-year degree or a four-year degree in college to really amount to anything. And I think that we're not doing a good service because so many of our kids don't get to that point. Only about 20% of all students in the state of Texas will get a career certificate, a two-year degree or a four-year degree. So we're doing a very poor job in that area as
well.
We
are. No, absolutely. And we see this being talked about more, right? We see the business community getting more engaged, but there's absolutely more that needs to be done from the public schools and higher ed, right? So then let's not even, I know we're about to wrap up, but I feel like there's a lot of false advertisement from some colleges or institutions who are saying, give me your money, and then what are they doing with
I mean,
it?
We could probably do a whole show on some of these career schools, these for-profit colleges that are doing just a poor job of getting kids a degree. And so many kids are leaving those places with lots of debt and not really getting the job. And the promise that was made is never being fulfilled. It's, it's a very interesting thing. Mandy, one last question. As we talk about full-day pre-K, the chances in the next legislative session, during the last legislative session, we had the governor say, oh, yeah, I want more high-quality pre-K in our state. But the state legislature sort of didn't live up to the governor's expectations, nor did they live up to our expectations, Mandy. What are the chances that this will be reintroduced, or is it one of those things that people aren't going to really be talking about?
Oh, I think that full-day pre-K will be introduced. And I'm optimistic, so I'm going to say there will be some conversations. But to be
You're
honest
optimistic.
With you, I am optimistic.
There'll be conversations,
but I don't know. I mean, we had budget cuts when in 2011, and it was before that when they were actually funding full day pre-K. I don't hear any legislators or the governor asking or demanding funding for full day quality pre-K. Do you? I don't. So
no,
it's a conversation that we're pushing.
We probably need to be pushing that more, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we should be having press conferences all across the state. I mean, because while it's not a silver bullet, it's as close to a silver bullet as we have, right? It's the thing that can have a very big impact.
Well, that's why we're trying to be innovative and create those public-private partnerships maybe that can help
that can
make
help.
That happen.
That can absolutely help. What a show, Mandy.
Yes.
A lot of public education stuff today. Good work, right?
Yep.
And Mandy, I want to thank you for all the hard work that you do. I mean, you are really one of the top policy experts in the state of Texas on all things children, and the work that you do is extraordinary.
You're so sweet. Thank you, Dr. Bob.
Oh, yeah. So, listen, it's another day of growing up in America. Certainly, I think, Mandy, I want to thank Dawn and Marissa. Marissa does such a good job as producer, doesn't
she?
Yes,
she does.
She is fantastic. So I want to thank her for all her hard work. And hug your kids, right? Those kids deserve a lot. We do this for children, so you do it for children as well. Thank you for listening to Growing Up in America. We'll see you next time here on KPFT Pacifica Radio.
Today's February 12th. On this day in 1955, African-American comedian, thespian, and talk show host Arsenio Hall was born. In 1989, Hall gained notoriety as the first African-American to host a late-night talk show, the Arsenio Hall Show, from 1989 to 1994. During the height of the show's popularity, Hall filmed a PSA about HIV/AIDS titled Time Out, The Truth About HIV, AIDS, and You with Magic Johnson to heighten awareness of the communicable disease.
Tell it on the mountain. Go talk it to the seashore. Whisper it in the breeze. Say it wherever you please. But it's a secret that needs to get out. So tell a friend that you heard it on KPFT. It's a secret that should be shouted out. From the highest overpass to the bends in the bayou, you heard it on KPFT. If it's worth hearing, if it's worth discussing, KPFT gets the word out. So tell a friend to turn on, tune in, and listen to radio for your mind. Call 713-526-5738 to sign up a friend today. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, listener-sponsored radio for peace.